Chapter 3. Vince. Concerning a fateful decision worthy of eternal remembrance and a daring escape from forced incarceration. I was really into white. I'd wear white satin pants with white leg warmers, Capizio shoes, chains around my waist, and a white t-shirt that I had ripped up the sides and sewn together with lace. I dyed my hair as white as I could get it and fluffed it until it added half a foot to my height. I was singing with Rock Candy at the Starwood, and life didn't get any better than that. Then Tommy showed up at one of our shows and tried to fuck everything up. I hadn't seen him in a year since I'd left continuation school, and he was sporting bright leather pants, stiletto heels, dyed black hair, and a ribbon around his neck. He was actually starting to look cool. Holy shit! I blurted. What did you do to yourself? I'm in a band now, dude, he said, with those guys over there. He gestured to two other black-haired rockers in the corner. I recognized one of them as the crazy, drug-addled loser bassist in London. The other was older and very serious-looking, not the type of person who comes to the Starwood to get laid. From the corner, the older guy was looking me up and down like I was prize beef. I told him about you, bro. Tommy said. They saw you tonight and they're stoked. I know you're in a band, dude, but come down and jam with us. We've got some cool motherfucking shit going on. Tommy asked me to audition with his band the next weekend. I was happy in Rock Candy, but I agreed anyway so that I wouldn't hurt his feelings. He had really helped me out when I left home in high school. He let me sleep in his van. And after his parents found out there was some homeless kid living in their driveway with all his clothes packed into a Henry Weinhardt case, they let me sleep on Tommy's bedroom floor until I found a new place to live. I was working at the time as an electrician, building a McDonald's in Baldwin Park. For job security, I started dating the boss's daughter, Leia, a tall, vaguely attractive bisexual blonde who, through some sort of elaborate mental airbrushing, believed that she looked like Rene Russo. She would show people modeling photos of Rene Russo and say they were pictures of her, which I actually believed. Leia, whom the band would later rename Lovey, was a filthy rich drug addict and bought me my first leather pants for $500 to wear on stage. I started living with her and driving her 280Z, but she drove me crazy. And I was stuck with her, not just because of the money, the car, the house, and the job, but because she had taught me how to inject cocaine and I was hooked. We would sit on the floor in her bathroom and shoot each other up while her parents ate or slept down the hall. One morning, after a four-day binge without sleep, my body began shutting down on me. It was 7 a.m. and I had to go to work. I vomited all over the car on the ride down the hill. I couldn't keep anything down. On the McDonald's job, I started hearing voices, seeing people who weren't there, and actually having conversations with them. Every few minutes or so, an imaginary dog would run by, and I'd look off into the distance trying to figure out where it had gone. I came home from work that night and slept for almost 20 hours. I woke up, shot up, and was just beginning to see straight when Tommy dropped by. He had a tape of songs for me to learn to sing. I listened to them and tried to keep from vomiting or laughing. There was no way I was going to play with this lame band, if you could call them a band. They didn't even have a name. So I blew off rehearsal, and when Tommy called to see what had happened, explained I'd accidentally washed the pair of jeans that had his number in them. And he believed me. I never even washed my clothes. I never wore jeans. And besides, I knew exactly where Tommy lived. I could have stopped by if I'd wanted to talk to him. A few days later, I heard that they'd found a singer, and I was happy for them. It meant I wouldn't have to hide from Tommy anymore when I saw him around the neighborhood. The next week, Rock Candy was supposed to play a house party in Hollywood. I showed up in a full white satin uniform, but our guitarist and bass player never arrived. I stood there like a fucking overdressed idiot, along with our drummer, while a house full of people shouted for music for 2 hours straight. I was fucking pissed. When I called the guitarist that night, he said he didn't want to play rock and roll anymore. He'd cut off his long blonde hair, bought a closet full of skinny ties, and decided that Rock Candy was going to be a new wave band. The next day, Tommy happened to call, and he said that their new singer wasn't working out. He was lucky. He got me when I was weak. When Motley Crue came on the scene, It was less as a band than as a gang. We'd get drunk, do crazy amounts of cocaine, and walk the circuit in stiletto heels, stumbling all over the place. The Sunset Strip was a cesspool of depravity. Prostitutes in spandex and needle-thin heels walked up and down the streets. Punks sat in clusters all over the sidewalk, and huge lines of new waivers wearing black, red, and white stood in block-long lines outside each club. Kim Fowley walked up and down Sunset, grabbing girls and throwing them in bands, while Rodney Bergenheimer strutted into clubs like the squat beige mayor of L.A., able to make or break bands with a single spin on his radio show. Every weekend, huge gangs of kids from North Hollywood, Sherman Oaks, and Sun Valley flooded onto the scene, leaving a thick cloud of Aquanet hairspray hanging over the strip. Whenever we weren't performing, we'd make the circuit. The Whiskey, the Roxy, and the Troubadour, nailing posters four at a time on each wall and lamppost. If every other band had one poster on a wall, we had to have four. That was Nicky's rule. I was 18 and too young to get in most places, so I'd use Nicky's birth certificate, which said Frank Farana. Everyone at the door knew who I was from Rock Candy, but they let me in anyway. When the clubs began to close, we'd go to the Rainbow. The place was set up like a circle, with the coolest rockers and richest deviants sitting at the center tables. Guys had to be 21 to come into the club, but girls could be 18. The guys would sit at their regular spots, and the girls would walk around the ring until they were called over to someone's empty chair. They would keep circling, like dick buzzards, until you filled your table with them. Afterward, everyone would spill out into the parking lot. Randy Rhoads, Ozzy Osbourne's guitarist, would be hanging upside down from a tree screaming while junkies tried to score dope and everyone else tried to scam on girls. Soon, with Robin Crosby and Stephen Piercy from Rat, who were only playing Judas Priest covers at the time, we started calling ourselves the Gladiators and giving each other titles like Field Marshal and King. One night, Nicky and I met strawberry blonde identical twins who were in the Doublemint Gum commercials and went back to their house. Afterward, we still couldn't tell which girl was which, so we'd have to wait each night at the Rainbow until they came up to us and said hi, because we didn't want to walk up and grab the wrong girl. Even though we couldn't afford coke, we could always sniff it out. We'd find someone who was holding and throw them into Tommy's Chevy van, which became our party truck. After the Rainbow each night, we'd walk to Santa Monica Boulevard, where all the young rockers and actors who never made it were pimping themselves. We'd scrounge up enough money to buy an egg burrito from Noggles. Then we'd bite the end off and stick our dicks into the warm meat to cover up the smell of pussy so that our girlfriends didn't know we were fucking anything stupid or drunk enough to get into Tommy's van. I didn't know what to think of Mick. He was crazy. He'd sit across the club from me scribbling on a piece of paper. Then he'd bring it over and it would say something like, "I'm gonna kill you." His face was all scruffy and unshaven, and he used to bite Tommy's nipple all the time. All Tommy would do is weakly swat him away and say, "Cut it out, that chafes." Through his day job at the Starwood, Nicky somehow managed to talk his boss into letting us play our first shows there. Two sets on Friday and Saturday opening up for Y&T. And even on stage, we acted more like a gang than a band. Mick was jittery because we'd never run through a complete show in rehearsal before. We didn't even know what our set list would be until Nicky taped a sloppy handwritten sheet of paper onto the stage floor at the last minute. During our first song, Take Me to the Top, people were yelling, "Fuck you," and flipping us the bird. Then one meathead in a black AC/DC shirt hocked loogie that landed on my white leather pants. Without even thinking, I leapt off the stage mid-phrase and put him in a headlock and started pummeling him. I looked back, and Nicky had his white Thunderbird bass over his head. He swung it forward like a circus strength game mallet and cracked it over some guy's shoulder blade. If there was a bell on the guy's head, it would have gone through the roof. We were so loose that I couldn't tell where one song ended and the next began. But we looked good and fought even better. By the end of the second set that night, we converted most of our enemies into fans. They told their friends and even more people came to see us the next night. When Y&T came out for their second set on Saturday, half the room had emptied. The next time we performed with Y&T, we would be the headliners. One of our first big fans was David Lee Roth. Just a year before, when Van Halen played the Long Beach Arena, I was in the parking lot bootlegging concert t-shirts. Now, Roth was introducing my band. Though we all knew it was not because he loved the music, but because he liked picking up the girls who came to see us, we were flattered. We were an unsigned, nothing band. He was a rock star. After our first show at the Troubadour, David came up to me. "Vince," he said, "do you know anything about the music business?" "Yeah, you get gigs and play music," I answered. "No," he said, "that's not what you do. Meet me tomorrow at Cantor's Deli on Fairfax at 3 p.m. The next day, David pulled up in his big Mercedes-Benz with his skull and crossbones painted on. He sat me down and launched into a monologue on the rock business. He named hustlers to avoid, scams to watch out for, and contract clauses to eliminate. "Don't go with the small distribution company," he said between mustard-dripping bites of pastrami. "You have to have your records in Tahiti. If they're not in Tahiti, they aren't anywhere else." And he went on. "Don't you sign with any manager. Don't take a deal only for the money. You have to watch where the money goes and how it comes back." Everything he had learned in the past 7 years he shared with me out of the sheer goodness of his alcohol-addled heart. I had no idea what he was talking about because I didn't know anything about the business. I proved that the very next day when I turned around and made one of the stupidest business mistakes of my career. I signed a 10-year management deal with a construction worker who knew even less about the industry than I did. I met him after mix chauffeur and burrito getter Stick started bringing his sister to rehearsal, where we were recording the songs that would become our first single, Stick to Your Guns, and Toast of the Town. She looked exactly like Stick, except she had only one tooth and a weird contraption that looked like a snake wrapped around her hair. She was so ugly that even Tommy wouldn't sleep with her. Her husband was a suspicious-looking, rail-thin construction company owner with a brain the size of Barney Fife's, but a heart bigger than a stripper's tit. His name was Alan Kaufman. He was from Grass Valley in Northern California, and for some reason he wanted to get into the rock scene. He looked like a psychotic yuppie, with eyes always darting around the room as if he were expecting something to leap out of the shadows and attack him. When he got drunk, he'd start obsessively searching bushes we passed to make sure no one was hiding in them. It wasn't until years later that we discovered he had served as an MP in Vietnam. When Stick brought him by rehearsal, he'd probably never seen a rock band before, and we'd never seen a manager. He said he wanted to invest in us and gave us $50, the first money we ever made as a band. We signed a management deal with him on the spot. Establishing a pattern we would repeat throughout our career, within minutes we had spent the entire wad on a pile of cocaine and snorted it in one long line that snaked around the table. Kaufman backed us because he thought it would be cheap. A punk band may have been cheap, but we weren't. We had him buy a snakeskin jacket and black pants for Tommy, a new leather jacket for Mick, and for Nikki, a $600 pair of boots. Back then, if we wanted anything that had a price tag in the three digits, we had to steal it. Kaufman thought he'd train us in Grass Valley and let us work out the kinks in our live shows. We slept in his guest trailer and hitchhiked into the town, a redneck paradise with only one road, Main Street. Despite the shit-kicker nature of the place, we weren't deterred from wearing stiletto heels, hairspray, red-painted fingernails, hot pink pants, and makeup. In full costume, we descended on the bars trying to score speed from truckers and pick up on anyone's girlfriend. On our first night out, a Hell's Angel walked into the bar and stopped in front of a biker with an angel's tattoo on his arm. "You don't deserve to be a Hell's Angel anymore," he said calmly. Then he clicked out a stiletto blade and cut the guy's tattoo off on the spot. One of the gigs Kaufman scored for us was at a place called the Tommy Knocker, which had a big sign outside announcing Hollywood Costume Night. We walked in and saw a dozen cowboys with their girlfriends handcuffed to them. Everybody was confused. They thought they looked Hollywood and had no idea what planet we had come from. We thought we were Hollywood and had no idea what planet they had come from. We played Stick to Your Guns and Livewire, but they just stared at us, still bewildered. So we decided to speak their language and ripped into Jailhouse Rock and Hound Dog, which they went crazy for. We played Hound Dog 5 times that night, then escaped through the back door before we got killed. That night, someone told us about a party in town. We walked in, and it was full of hot chicks we had never seen before. After about 15 minutes, Tommy nudged me and said, These aren't chicks, dude. We looked around and realized that we were surrounded by freaky country bumpkin drag queens who were probably wearing their wives' and girlfriends' clothes. I asked the big blonde next to me if he had any coke, and he sold me a bag for $20. I went into the bathroom to shoot up and almost killed myself. It was baby powder, and I was pissed. When the drag queen wouldn't give me my money back, I pulled his wig off, spun him around, and hit him in the face. Blood leaked over his lipstick, dribbling down his chin. All of a sudden, a dozen redneck transvestites descended on us, flailing and kicking with their high heels before throwing us into the street, a torn and bleeding lump of Hollywood trash. The next day, Kaufman arranged our first radio interview. We showed up at the studio with fat lips, bruises, and black eyes, and we were scared shitless. We had never done a radio interview before. They asked us where we were from, and we looked at each other speechless. Then Mick said Mars. After more nightmares that Kaufman called training, we migrated back south to Los Angeles, playing concerts and putting posters on every telephone pole we saw. They dropped me off at Lovey's, and within a minute I was in the bathtub shooting up with her while she blathered on about how Alan Kaufman was going to wear us out and how we should let her manage us with her dad's money. She was driving me out of my mind, especially since I'd started sleeping with a much nicer, cuter, and saner surfer girl who lived down the street. Lovey and I ended up partying until dawn at the house of a guy who was an heir to U.S. Steel, but was living in a squalid one-bedroom house because his family had cut him off. The next evening, I was still shooting up at Lovey's when I realized we had a gig at the country club in 10 minutes and I was stuck. I didn't have a car or any way to get down the hill she lived on. I sprinted out of the door and ran downhill until I managed to hitch a ride. I arrived at the club 45 minutes late, still wearing a bathrobe. The guys were freaked out. They were pissed that I was using needles and showing up for gigs dressed like an old man. They told me that if I shot up one more time, I was out of the band. They were so furious and self-righteous that it was hard to bite my tongue a few years later when Nikki and Tommy were using needles. From that night on, I was determined to escape from Lovey. I was stranded on Gilligan's Island, dependent on her money or her car if I wanted to go anywhere, and her drug supply if I didn't. A few mornings later, while Lovey was asleep, Tommy drove up to the house. I bundled my clothes in a sheet and threw them in the back of his truck. I didn't leave a note or even bother to call her afterward. She stopped by Tommy's every day after that, thinking she'd catch me there, but I managed to avoid her for 3 days. Then, when we were getting ready to take the stage for a gig at the Roxy, I spotted her pushing through the audience and told security to kick her out. Later that month, I moved into a 2-bedroom apartment on Clark Street, just 50 steps from the Whiskey A Go-Go, which Kaufman had bought to keep Nikki, Tommy, and me together near the clubs. I didn't see Lovey again until 15 years later, back at the Roxy, when I was playing a solo gig. After the show, around midnight, she came backstage, dragging a little girl behind her that she said was her daughter. Just a few months later, I saw her on the news. She'd been stabbed 60 times in a drug deal gone wrong. I often wonder what became of her daughter, and hope that she wasn't mine.